Welcome to Life List, a birding podcast.
Hello, hello. Welcome, welcome, everybody. I am George Armistead. I am with Molly Brown, Alvaro Jaramillo. We are Life List, a birding podcast. Welcome, all listeners, and welcome, guys. Great to see your faces. It's been a while.
It really has.
Yeah, yeah. I don't even know how long.
Yeah.
Weeks, months.
Feels like a long time. Yeah.
Yeah, especially for all three of us.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. When I edit these podcasts, sometimes I get ahead. Generally, I'm not. So over the past couple episodes that we'd banked, I've been hearing your voices as I'm editing the episodes like the day before they go out. And it feels like I've talked to you a little bit, but no, it's good. Now we're actually all here. I get to participate.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Imagine Al feels that way a little bit himself after all those Columbia pods.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true. And hey, also we have, it seems like, been climbing up the charts in the podcast.
It's true.
Yeah. We have been.
Thank you, everybody, for listening or telling your friends or something's going on. But, you know, still, we got to beat all those podcasts about the Yeti and
Bigfoot, man. What is with the Bigfoot pods, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's Bigfoot. That's our biggest competitor in the nature.
Yeah. World.
Oh, yeah.
Nature. There's like five or six of those pods. They're always in like the top 20 or something, you know? It's like,
no.
It feels unfair.
No, it's unfair.
They shouldn't be categorized. There should be like a separate cryptozoology, you know, pod, you right. know, category.
Yeah, but people can't spell that. So
yeah, it's true. And crypto would probably lead them whole down a whole different right. rabbit hole. Like, so
yeah, exactly. Yeah. This kind of crypto is not going away. The Bigfoot crypto. My gosh.
Yeah.
I haven't listened to them. Maybe they're super good, and I'm like.
Yeah. That's true. I haven't listened either.
Yeah.
Do you think they've listened to ours or?
Yeah.
I wonder if there's any crossover. Yeah.
No, there
that's
might
a
be.
Crossover to look at.
Yeah.
You think we should try? Yeah, they would probably be big on the ivory-billed woodpecker front. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, yeah. There's probably some Bigfoot birders out there. I know there's some UFO birders.
Oh yeah.
That have. Complete in you know, they have seen the UFOs, they know all about them and all that kind of stuff. I'm not knocking it, I'm just saying that they're into it. And
did I ever tell you about, I had an experience, Dave Stayskull and I were leading a Argentina tour in like northwest Argentina, I think we're in like Saltas or something.
Oh, and perfect habitat actually.
Yeah, we were like looking for black-bodied woodpeckers, you know, and it's like me and Dave and 14 other birders, and we're like just kind of walking along, or we pull into a parking lot, and there's like six vans, news crews that are there, and nobody else. And we get out with our telescopes and binoculars, cameras, and they all start swarming us. And they're like, you're here, you're here. You came for the scheduled alien landings. You know, but they're saying this in Espanol or in Castellano. And I was like, my Spanish is pretty good, but I don't think they're talking about what I think they're talking about. And we kind of figured it out. And they thought there was like long predicted to be this alien landing there. And we roll up these birders with all our gear. And they're like, they start interviewing us. And little, like, what are the odds? We actually had a guy on the tour who was a big UFO guy. Like he believed that the Earth had already been colonized by aliens. And he told us all at dinner one night how you could recognize the aliens by their slightly pointier ears. They tended to be tall and slender. There's a couple other like subtle features that pointed to these aliens.
That could be me. That could be me. Am I an alien?
I didn't mean to suggest anything, Al, but, you know, well, could be.
A little bit more slender.
Yeah, pretty close to the mark.
Younger, yeah. But
if you can pick out aliens, I bet you're pretty good at, like, shorebird ID.
Yeah.
Hey, is this the guy who also used to be, like, a colonel in the Air Force?
That sounds right. I remember his name. We can talk about it later.
Yeah, I remember his name. I don't want to say
He was like a big believer in world government, and that like soap operas were used to like control the minds of humans around the world and stuff.
Yeah, that was when this kind of stuff was funny.
Yeah, exactly. Now it's just like commonplace.
Oh, yeah. It's like insane people run the world now.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Keep it interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. But so hold on. You didn't finish. Did they land the aircraft, the spaceship, the UFO?
You know, I got to say, it was difficult to look for black-bodied woodpeckers with like these news crews swarming around us all the time. So we actually left the guy who was like the believer. And they interviewed him. They were trying to interview like Dave and I. We were kind of obviously like, you know, looking leader-esque. And we were like, no, we're not here for all this. But the other guy was like, the dude was like, our dude who was a believer, he was like, yeah. He's like, I'll talk to you. Yeah, let's go. And they like started, they interviewed him. And we were like, all right, you guys go over there. And we like went around looking for birds. But I think we cut out after like half hour, 40 minutes. And there, you know, so far as we know, there never was a landing, but you know, we weren't there to see, so you know, who knows? Right.
You know what's really weird is in Salta, you're sort of coming down off the mountains, and there's this big reservoir. It's often good for like, what am I going to say, like, I don't know, comb duck or something. There's
La Presa.
There's this reservoir there, and I remember stopping there for some reason to go see, you know, looking for some birds on tour. And the news team actually pulled up and interviewed me about like what we were doing. So it's like, I think that's just the part of the world you get interviewed. You know, so don't stop.
It's a cultural thing. It's just like, there's like news crews roaming around looking for people to interview.
Right. They figure if you're this stretch, you got to be interesting, you know, especially if you got binoculars. So it's like, but yeah, they interview all the time. In fact, those are probably aliens interviewing random people to figure out how the world works.
God, that would explain a lot. Huh? Yeah.
Explains a lot.
Yep.
Yeah. They already had landed, you see, and then they covered it up by saying that they were waiting for the landing.
It's a pretty slick maneuver right there.
I know. I know. Hmm. And they learned how to speak Spanish like Argentinians, which is really hard.
That is very difficult. That vos thing, I can't get that right. Yeah. Yeah. Vosos. Well,
that wasn't even on our set of topics.
That was not. Yeah. So one thing I did want to ask both of you guys, I had this thing that happens to me fairly regularly. And like, I find it a little frustrating where like, I'll see people and they'll be like this happened twice this week. And it actually has happened to me fairly regularly before. Where I'll see somebody be like, hey, you lose weight? You lose some weight? You know, drop a few pounds? And I'm like, I think people just always think that I'm fatter than I am. You know? Like, I think in other people's minds, I am a heavier dude than I am in real life. Because I get this question way too much. And like,
maybe it's the camera puts on a few pounds. And
well, it definitely does that. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, so they see you on Facebook and then live.
It's the podcast.
Yeah, but I feel like it's meant as a compliment, but it sort of feels like, hey, you know, you're finally looking a little better, you know. Thanks, that's great.
That is interesting. I'm like trying to process that. Like,
yeah,
so this happens regularly.
It does. I'd be lying if I said it didn't. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I
know. I also get I get confused for other people a lot. And I was going to ask you guys if you ever have, like, if you've got doppelgangers, famous or otherwise. One of my favorite ones that happened to me was I was down at the Rio Grande Birding Festival. And I saw another person from at one of the booths that was working there. And she said, hey, so what'd you think of the talk last night? And I was like, you know, I missed it. I didn't get to go. You know, I wrapped up here at the booth. It was pretty beat up. Just went and crashed out. And she's like, no, I saw you there. And I was like, no, I don't think so. I hightailed it home. I was not there. And she's like, you were sitting right next to me. And I was like, are you sure you're not thinking of Michael O'Brien, maybe? And just at that moment, Michael O'Brien walks by and goes, hey, George. And she turns to me and she goes, it was Michael O'Brien.
That guy. Yeah. Didn't you used to get confused with Ned Brinkley as well?
Yes. Yeah, that happened. And I feel like, you know, slightly portly bearded white guys, it's a real type in birding, you know? Yeah. It is a, it's a thing. It is, well, you know, it's a real type. We exist. And well, so
you're not portly anymore now that you've lost a few pounds, George.
Or just not as portly, I guess. Yeah. But yeah, it's, I don't know. It's a real type. Like I am routinely, people say, sorry, I looked just like you the other day. And I'm like, okay, great. I look like a million other people.
Like, I don't know, extend your mustache or something, like do something where it's like really unique. So
do you think I should do like the handlebar curly Q thing going like on? That?
Yeah. Yeah. Or, you know, or a weird, you know, little patterns in your beard, like little, you know,
maybe some like little dots here, or do the big porno mustache, nothing else. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's always like signature face tattoo or
right neck tattoo.
So that's news, Molly. Kristen got a tattoo yesterday.
Ooh, I saw that on Instagram.
Yeah, she got a tattoo yesterday. I knew that was coming. Yeah, and she told me, she was like, you know, I nearly got a YOLO tattoo on my forehead. I just love the idea. Like big YOLO on your forehead. Well, you only live once, you know. Gonna do it.
That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. At least a Sharpie or something on there.
Yeah, I was thinking to do it. And she should have come home with that, like having sharpened it on her forehead. Yeah. Like, check it out.
When's your tattoo coming?
Yeah, I told you about this, right? We were thinking about it. Mm-hmm. She actually ended up taking my slot because her work was such that she kind of needed to do it then. So, yeah, I think I'm going to be doing mine a few months from now. I'm just do a little guy. She had a more serious endeavor, so.
Mm-hmm. I do little guy tattoos. That's my thing too.
Yeah, I like those little birds you got. I'm kind of shooting for something similar.
Alvaro, do you have any tattoos?
No, nothing. I realized when I was like a teenager and everybody was getting a tattoo that I was like, I'm going to rebel by not getting a tattoo. Mm.
That was kind of the way I went as well. Yeah. I'm going the other way.
Yeah, it's interesting. My dad got a tattoo when. Like in his 70s. So it's always
time. Wow.
Yeah.
That guy.
Wild. Good for him. I know. Your dad should get a squirrel.
Pay for it. Yeah. So neck tattoo.
Like, you know, the lifeless folks, we could all chip in and get like a big, big old squirrel from.
Mm-hmm. You know, he might actually do it. He might go for it.
A giant squirrel, like the one I just saw in Bhutan.
Oof. Those things are big.
It's huge. Yeah.
Yeah.
But tattoos, what are you going to get?
I'm going to get, I feel like I can't say it until I do it. I feel like I feel like I got to hold out. I think Molly knows, but I think I'll give you the rundown.
You seem like you're about to back out.
Well, you're kind of calling me here. I've vacillated. Like, and the truth is I've been vacillating here for quite some time. But I do want to do it, especially now that these guys have theirs. I feel like I got to go get mine done.
Mm-hmm. I assume you're going to get it in your lower back.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, precisely. Yeah. So it's, you know what it's going to say, Al? It's going to say YOLO, you know?
Yeah.
Better sign your name, too, so people know who you are.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I need to know if you guys have doppelgangers.
Oh, yeah.
Oh yeah,
Molly.
I don't have doppelgangers. A few years back, actually, like 10 years back, up through college, my hair was a lot longer and it was pretty blonde. And especially when I was like out of the country, I got Taylor Swift a lot, just because I had blonde curly hair and a little bit of an accent, and that carried at that point. But I don't get that anymore.
You didn't walk around with a guitar or anything like that.
Did not do that. Okay. Wasn't singing either. Nope. That was
enough. Work for you, Molly. I could see you doing that, like walk around Reading, you know, Taylor Swift country, See,
yeah. I don't think it'd be a far stretch.
Might be good for Halloween.
But you know what? Actually, the opposite. There have been a couple times, and I'm trying to remember when it was. It happened just recently. I don't think it was on our tour, George, but I'm trying to think where it was. A few times, someone has said, like, oh, there was a young girl from West Virginia that, like, guided me at a festival a few years ago. Seems like it'd be pretty obvious that was me.
Yeah, it's like there pretty much couldn't be anybody around. But me. Yeah.
I've had multiple times where people were surprised that they've seen me in multiple places. So they're like going very far out of their way not to remember me. That's all I got.
Nice.
Wow. I feel like I mentioned this before on here or something, but maybe it's because it comes up a bunch, but in the past, you know, when I was a little slimmer or whatever, I was confused for The Rock multiple times.
Yes, I do remember this. Yeah.
And I remember this one kid, especially. I was like lining up to get on an airplane, and the kid's like, Dad, look, it's The Rock. And I heard this, right? And the dad looks at me and he's like, shakes his head. And I look at the kid and I did the eyebrow thing, you know? And then the kid was like, you see, it is him.
He's like, oh my God, it really is him.
That's all it took. But, you know, then I had to tell him that The Rock probably was like three times more muscular in size than I am.
I think you're selling yourself short there, RL. Yeah.
You know, I might be tall and, you know, I don't know, we have the same head shape. But
yeah. Yeah, so, ginormous head. Head like a watermelon, you know? It's like, yeah.
Like a watermelon. Like a melon. Yeah. But you know, on the whole, like, I can't complain. Like, it's not like, hey, you look like Woody Allen or something. I was like, oh, crap, you know? Sort of like.
I got to tell you, the tough one I got was, and I'm sure I've told probably both of you guys this story and certainly some other friends, but I once went to a Halloween party as Magnum PI. This is dating me a little bit, right? Like Magnum PI hasn't been on television forever, but I loved that show as a little kid. And so I went as like Tom Selleck, Magnum PI. I had like the Detroit Tigers hat on, like mustache and Hawaiian shirt and like some short shorts or something. And I walk up and I ring the doorbell and somebody answers the door and she goes, ha, Michael Moore. I love it.
Oh my God. And then did you have to just leave? Cause you couldn't at that point.
It took a lot of strength to then enter that front door. It took a lot of intestinal fortitude. Yeah.
I do like that. You told me once you dressed up like Che Guevara.
Oh yeah.
And went to a party, and who did you meet at the party?
Oh, yeah. The first guy I saw was dressed as Fidel Castro, and he immediately came over and handed me a cigar. It was awesome. It's like, and we just sat there. People started taking, like, you know, phone pics out and stuff. That was so great. Yeah.
See, that's good. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, you have impressive Halloween game.
Yeah. I did have some good ones, yeah.
And maybe that's good about being sort of the bearded
everyman
kind of moldable. You're sort of like, you know, plasticine.
Kind of like the Ben Kingsley of bearded birding dudes. I can I can play a lot of parts. Yeah.
You can play a lot of parts.
Yeah.
You know, I can do none maybe well, but, The Rock or Vin Diesel, that's it. You know. Don't laugh too hard there, George.
I just picture the little kid seeing you cock that eyebrow. That eyebrow. Oh, man. Well, let's see. We are 20 minutes in here, and we have barely spoken about a bird. Yeah, we should talk about birds. What I would like to know, first and foremost, is Molly Brown, you've been moving and grooving around this Southwest and Eastern United States. What have you been seeing at home? What have you been seeing on the road? What have you been seeing?
Yeah, I was gone most of March and April, I guess, and was in Georgia and Florida for a couple of different reasons. Wrapped up some work that was on reforestation projects and wasn't burning a lot, but was just in pine forests and a lot of places that rely, do like prescribed burning research, that sort of thing. So it was like red cockaded woodpecker, Bachman sparrow territory. Nice. I stayed for a week at a research facility outside of Tallahassee, and it was so cool. And that was really great. And that was
some of the nicest of piney woods habitat in the world, I think, is right in that area. They say some of the biggest chunks. Yeah.
It's really like the heart of management for that, and like the research and the infrastructure that's going into that. Tall Timbers is the name of this research facility, mm-hmm. which has like a lot of different birding projects that are happening, because I think it's several thousand acres, and they manage like a massive region of like land trust type things. So that was pretty cool. Then came home for a few days and went right back down to Key West for a wedding, which was really exciting. My first time in South Florida. And we actually drove down. So we took our time coming back up and kind of birded our way up to Florida before we were on to our next endeavor. But I hadn't been to the Keys before. It was really fun. It was really hot. And we were there for 3 nights, but it was a lot of wedding activities, so it wasn't really getting out a ton. Missed Antillean Nighthawks that were back in that week, and that hurt a little bit because we had stuff at like 6 o'clock every night, and then, you know, we were partaking in festivities and was not rallying to bird too much after that.
I see.
But anyway, got the Key West experience. So that was cool. And this was for Jimmy, my fiance's sister, got married down there. And she set her wedding like last summer. And the first thing I did was look at booking a camping trip on Dry Tortugas, and it was already sold out.
Yeah.
So that was, I thought we were far enough ahead, but that didn't happen. But it was a really, really fun taste. And now I want to get down there and explore it thoroughly and, you know, have some unstructured time and get out to the Dry Tortugas. And
did you see the key deer, the little deer?
We did. So we have an electric car, and we stopped on whatever that last major key is. Is it like Big Pine Key? That was where the car charger was. And there were deer in the dumpster beside the car chargers. So we hung out with them for like 30 minutes. And a bunch of chickens around too. So, which I actually haven't. Yeah. I guess I've been going back and listening to old podcast episodes, because I was just listening to the last time we had that conversation on the podcast. But, yeah. It was a fun experience though. And we gave a non-birding family friend a ride from Key West up to Gainesville over the next several days. He had family up there and kind of just needed to get from point A to point B. So we drove up, and he just came along with the ride for us, and got his intro to birding, which was pretty fun. We stayed around the Everglades for a couple nights, and also found out it was his birthday the second day he was with us. And we were like, we got to do something to make this fun. He hadn't told us beforehand. So he actually really loved it, and like downloaded Seek, like the iNaturalist companion app. That's, you know, the equivalent of Merlin to eBird, and started using that. Loved the alligators. Really got into the birding. There were manatees there, you know, just like really fun stuff that anyone can enjoy. And started working our way just slowly north from there, and ended up in the sort of Merritt Island, Space Coast area. And we're birding up that way. And by the end, the last morning, we went to Orlando Wetlands, which is one of my favorite places that I've been to a lot.
Oh, that place is awesome. Yeah.
Oh, it's so fun. We were going to do Black Point Drive on Merritt Island as our last stop, and there's prescribed burning going on, and it was all shut down. So had to reroute around that, which was too bad. But anyway, still fun stuff out there. But we were at Orlando Wetlands, and we had a good species list, like 70 species or something. And it was so cool because our friend Mike, by that point, he knew most of the birds. And like, he was great at using binoculars. He was really into just like checking out everything that was around. I thought we would really be going too slowly to entertain him, but it was more like pulling him along to keep up with us. And
that's awesome.
It was just fun. It very much, I mean, Florida is such a place for, you know, the ornithotherapy experience and just enjoying birds. And that's pretty much what we did.
It's a great place. You can really immerse yourself there. It's so great for that.
Yeah. And it was my first time in the Everglades too. I hadn't been to any of that. So that was just pretty incredible. Getting out in those cypress swamps and that sort of thing.
See any big pythons? Really fun.
Python trucks.
Oh, really?
But yep, no snakes. We actually went out one night and just drove into that Anhinga Trail that's just a few miles into that main Everglades entrance. And that was the night it was Mike's birthday. So we had some pie back at our Airbnb in Homestead and then thought we'd just drive out there and looked around. Didn't have any snakes, and not that we're great snake searchers. And we just looked for, an hour or so. And that was about it. But yeah, alligator, crocodile, manatee, and Holly Merker had given me some birding recommendations for the South Florida area too, and stopped at, I'm forgetting the name of this wetlands. It's there's Cave Nature Preserve. No, we were farther south than all of that.
Okay, this is down in the Everglades.
It was closer to like just north of Miami. But okay. We stopped at a place that had a boardwalk that kind of went out, and it was like a mile walk, and there were tons and tons of wood storks and great egrets nesting, and glossy ibis and tricolored heron, like deafening amounts. And I had not seen, and I mean, they're like arm's reach from you too. So it was packed with people. It was a really cool boardwalk. It kind of felt like, I don't know, biggest week vibes, but yeah, just like people from the community and birders and photographers, and just a really cool spectacle of a gorgeous area that was one of those like water treatment facilities that was managed for wildlife habitat. So it was a good Florida experience.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool.
Yeah.
Fun spots down there.
Really is. I don't really get tired of it. I used to go down there for Space Coast every year up until the pandemic, and hadn't been since. So
yeah, felt
good to get a dose of that.
I remember the first time I went to Space Coast, I was kind of like, I guess I'll go do this, you know, like whatever. And then I was down there, I was like, this is awesome. Like yeah, really Merritt is. Island, Vera Wetlands, all those mm-hmm. spots down there. I was like, this is amazing. Like,
and the multiple dumps where you can
go. That's right. All those, all the landfills for the gulls. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And you can go in them. Like they don't, it's not like the rest of the world where it's like, get out of here, kids.
Yeah.
You know, we it's have true. Work to do. They're like, come on in, you know, you can talk about landfills.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, like, and literally water treatment facilities that have boardwalks built throughout them. It's so bizarre. But pretty fun stuff. Oh, yeah. And we went to Dixie Crossroads and had a big shrimp feast.
Oh, yeah. Get the rock shrimp. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So
that's the way to do it.
That was great. I was hyping that up the whole trip, and I think it impressed our little group. So it was good.
Wow. You're taking me right back there with the rock shrimp. I got to go do that stuff. Again. Yeah.
Holds up.
Nice.
Yeah. Other than that, I've been home for 10 days or so and don't have a ton of travel planned for the next few months, which is great. I love this time of year and really like being here in West Virginia. So I'm kind of settling into like just getting out and doing a little bit of birding each morning. Like, you know, an hour, two, nothing too crazy, and kind of migration starting to ramp up. I'd be curious how it is your way, George.
God.
Really?
I'm so like it looks like tomorrow's finally going to be nice, but it's been cold and rainy and gray and like so uninspiring for like a week. And I've been trying to go out. I feel like I haven't seen anything yet. But it's coming. I think this weekend is going to, I think the floodgates are going to bust open. It should be great. So,
yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's looking like that our way too. And it hasn't been too crazy. It's just, and we've had really crappy weather the past few days.
Yep.
Like below freezing.
Yeah. So it's been in the 40s here. Yeah. It's been like it's been 40 degrees in the low 40s. Yeah.
But it is green here now. So, you know, it's looking good. I have really, I've been hitting up like wildflowers as much as I have birds the past few days and getting all that in too and just enjoying all of that.
And fishers? What about fishers?
And fishers. Yeah. Yeah. Man. So, still have yet to see them, but they're regularly on the trail cam. You mentioned something, George, and I think what I had put on Instagram the other day was we had a gray fox come in.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw this.
Yes,
and
I did.
So we get these like 15-second video recordings on our trail cam too. And it's got sound, which usually isn't that beneficial, but a gray fox just like stopped and barked for 15 seconds straight
right
in front of the camera. It was really cool. It's a pretty good little video of it. It's at night, but
they're pretty scarce around here.
Moving around.
We got tons of red foxes everywhere, but we don't, you know, I've seen gray fox mid-Atlantic, just like 3 times I can think of. Yeah.
It's a very, really? Well, do you have red as well?
That's a good question. We actually have an introduced population of reds in the lowlands, but there's a native Sierra red fox, which is super rare endangered.
Wow.
So we have this two reds. One is good red, one's a bad red.
Wow.
I like that there's a lot of judgment attached there. That was great.
Yeah.
Are the introduced like doing well? Are they gaining territory there?
Yeah, they are. Actually, spreading and I've seen them here and there. They're not abundant. I still see gray fox more commonly, but they also gray fox sometimes comes in when you're squeaking, like when you're booming, and they sort of come out of nowhere and go.
I squeak in red foxes too. I've had red foxes squeaking. Yeah, crab eating foxes like crazy. They love a good squeak. Yeah.
Crab eating fox.
Yeah. Huh.
Maybe crab squeak.
Yeah.
Only when you eat them.
Yeah. Wow. I'm so jealous of this fisher, Molly. I'm going to come like camp out on your guys' doorstep just for like a week just to like have a chance.
Yeah. If I could pick up on any sort of
regular
predictability with it. Yeah. I would be. I know they cover a large area, and I don't know where they're coming from. It's pretty interesting though. Yeah, lots of good mammals recently. Just seeing a lot, and I'm getting out more. Like, I haven't been home. I think I've been gone more than I've been home so far this year, and I'm really excited for that to flip. I'm just kind of like settling into that routine, and you know, seeing stuff because I'm actually getting out, and that feels pretty good.
Good time of year to be home.
Mm-hmm.
Alvaro, you have not been home much lately.
No, I'm home for like 3.5 days between trips. Like,
do your laundry and repeat.
Yeah.
You're going back to Japan and you were like just in Japan like yesterday or something, right?
Right. I stopped over in Japan on my flight back from Bhutan, Bangkok, Japan. And I had multiple hours. So I went out, got on a couple of trains and went birding kind of right near Tokyo Disney at Kasai Rinkai Park. And,
Azure-winged magpies?
No, actually they weren't there, but they're usually there, but there were a lot of migrant shorebirds. Like a lot of gray-tailed tattlers were around.
So
it was kind of neat. Things you don't see every day.
Yeah.
It was fun. I mean, rather than sticking around the airport, I thought I'd do that. But I got on a plane, came home, here doing my laundry, podcast or two, and then flying right back to Japan for this spring trip. But it's good to be home. It's like people are like, why are you doing that? It's like, what am I going to do? Just, you know, I've been traveling for weeks. You know, I'm not going to sit around traveling more. I'd rather be home for a little bit, do some work, open the mail. What have you. Besides, it's not really that difficult for me to, you know, sleep on a plane and get over here. It's yeah, I just sleep through them. So it's
like, yeah,
it's like yeah. being in a hotel.
There you go. You got to tell us about this Bhutan trip. I mean, it looked just wild, man, like really practically a different planet. Really beautiful scenescape, some crazy looking birds, mm-hmm. like this flying in there alone, getting to your starting kind of your main starting point looked a little dicey, a little hairy. What was this trip like?
Well, I mean, we started in, we had a few days before the tour in Bangkok to do a little pre-tour, you know, get everybody all gathered in there. Cause you have, there's only a few places that you can fly into Bhutan to Paro from, and Bangkok's one of the gateways. So to give you an idea of how good the trip was, we started in Thailand, saw a bunch of things, like really high quality birds, including spoon-billed sandpiper. Oof. And by the end of the trip in Bhutan, somebody said, you know what? I'd totally forgotten I'd seen a spoon-billed sandpiper. We've seen so much good stuff,
you know,
that it was that level. And breeding plumage Asiatic douchers in Thailand was amazing for me.
That saw kind of those thing. Pictures.
It was really, really neat. But the thing about, so here's the thing. Paro Airport is in a valley within the mountains, and it's not a particularly wide valley. It's not like some massive valley like in the Rockies, you know. It's just a narrow valley, and they land planes there. You know, this is, we were on a Airbus 320, so it's not a, you know, it's a smaller end jet, but it's not a small plane. And the thing about it is that it's often labeled as one of the most dangerous airports in the world. And actually, I think it's not the case, because there are about 10 pilots that can fly in there that are seasoned and are, you know, licensed to fly into this place.
10.
They know it. Like, I think there's 10. Yeah.
That doesn't seem like very many.
No, yeah. But there's only, I mean, I think the two airlines in Bhutan probably have 5 planes, you know, like between them or something, you know, it's not, and it may, the number may be higher now, I don't know. But the truth is that they're so seasoned at this that, and they know exactly the conditions that you can fly in, and you can only do it in the day, right? There's no nocturnal flying in there, that it doesn't feel at all unsafe or like how they, you know, internet, it's like, you know, 10 most dangerous. On the other hand, I see like airports in other parts of the Himalayan, you know, sort of region that seem way more dicey than this one to me, in any case, you know, the one that, you know, when you go into the gateway for Everest, that looks crazy, where you can only land in one direction and you have to take off in the same direction. It's sort of off a cliff. That's crazy. But the thing here though, is that I think what gets people is that you're winding through the mountains and right at the end, right, you're not lined up with the runway. So the plane is making a turn one way, and then it has to turn kind of the other way. And then while it's making that turn and finishing that turn, it straightens out and lands.
So it's like a fishtail landing kind of thing?
No, I mean, it's like you cannot line up with the runway because there's a hill in the way. So you've got to go around this hill and then make the turn back towards the runway. And right at the last moment, you know, you just sort of slap the plane down.
Wow.
So I think there's a name for this. It's like, I'll think of it, but it's the only airport, I think, international airport where that is the case, like where you cannot line up, you know, for a ways back. I think it's called an unstabilized landing. That's what
it is. Wow. Doesn't sound particularly inviting. No.
And then they, and all of the stuff is done visually. So they know, like, if you see the house, the yellow house on the left, turn right at that point, you know, and just before you hit the blue house on the right, then turn left. So it's flying pretty low, but next to some of these hills.
And next to somebody's house, apparently, as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like the houses are pretty close. And it's, it's every time I've landed, it's been kind of flawless. And apparently it's pretty rare that they have to do a go around or anything like that. You know, that it's usually the conditions are clear, like you can land or you can't. So they'll either wait for the conditions or what have you. And even that, I've never had to wait. Like, it's always seemed to be like clear and fine. So it's, I think, some folks might be freaked out by it, but all of our folks thought it was the most impressive, beautiful landing they've ever had, you know, kind of thing. It's like, wow, kind of landing, you know, because you're seeing stuff all the way along and the plane turns and there's all of this vegetation and houses and mountains, and it's pretty neat.
What elevation are you? What elevation are you there?
It's not that high.
Okay.
I know. I don't want to say, like, is it 5,000 feet or something? Mm-hmm.
But you're basically right in the mountains, and it's the Himalayas, right. Beautiful, verdant. And probably this time of year, the azaleas are all popping.
Yeah, pine forest. And it's a little, you get a little higher and you get spruce and larch and all this kind of stuff. And then you get into moisture oaks, and then you get down into the subtropics and tropical zone. And then it's really tropical. You see it all over there. I think more than the landing, there are some roads that are cut through the cliffs where your bus is, you know, sort of.
You're straight up 1,000 feet on one side, thousands feet on one side, straight down on the other. Yeah.
So you need to have people there who are great drivers and experienced. And, you know, you don't want to go with a sort of inexperienced tour operator in that case, because that's pretty, to me, that's hairy. You know, that really scares some people versus landing, you know, that mountain driving kind of deal. And there's not one straight road in the entire country, but
it's all,
there's lots of birds, and you never go that fast anyways. It's like sort of, it's not like a,
cause there's lots of birds. You can't go too fast.
Lots of birds. Yeah. And there's lots of curves, so you can't be going that fast. I think we saw over 300 species of birds, but really iconic stuff. Ibis bill, the Ward's Trogon, people kind of see that as one of the iconic Bhutan birds. It's basically a pink trogon, at least the male. And the beautiful nuthatch, which is beautiful. Things like, there's a lot of oddball birds with weird names out there, you know, the Mesias and Kudias and Minlas and all that. And you're like, what are these things? Shrike babblers, you know, scimitar babblers. And they're all pretty cool looking things. And to some extent, like from a New World perspective, there's also some birds that have these patterns that are just absent from New World birds. A lot of barring patterns that are odd, like barred, you know, like the actual wings have crosswise barring on them, which is really unusual. Right. If you start thinking about it, you know, we tend to have birds that have barring on the bellies, but not on the wings, and mixes of green with, you know, kind of coppery colors, red, blue. And you just think, like, wow, nothing like that in the New World.
Yeah.
And it's not that they're more colorful, but they're colorful in a different way than tanagers
or what have you. Like, not having really done this experience, like, I kind of imagine, like, if you lived, and it's very different, I realize this, but like the Appalachians in like May, a lot of really colorful, beautiful songbirds, but, you know, they're not as, you know, we're talking about a lot of warblers, right, where we are, whereas there you've kind of, you got a bunch of different families involved
Laughing thrushes and bar wings and.
But that's kind of the nearest parallel I can kind of think of. But I'm sure it's not necessarily a great one. But to me, I don't know. I have it kind of in that mind.
Yeah, and there is so much forest in Bhutan. Like I think it's something like 70-something% of the country is forested. So low population density. Compared to Nepal, for example, you know, Nepal's got really high population, a lot of deforestation. So, and same with northern India, right? So Bhutan is really this island of forest with low population compared to all of its neighbors. And you see big eagles, you know, sort of forest eagles, either mountain hawk eagles or crested serpent eagles, these every day. Every day. It's not like, here's the one we're going to see in this trip, you know, kind of thing. Like, it's every day you see these big eagles, black eagle. And that to me was a sign of, wow, there's like a lot of squirrels or a lot of stuff for these things to eat because there's so much forest.
Black eagle, like they specialize in, yeah, like rodents and hyrax, a lot of places, I think, yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I don't think there's hyrax here, but
no, no.
Yeah. Giant squirrels.
Yeah. Wow. You didn't even mention the crazy pheasants and game birds there, too, which I feel like those are a signature a part of that as well. But it just speaks to the
monal.
Yeah.
That satyr tragopan, which I made the Bhutanese laugh because I said, you know, tragopan means I swallow bread in Spanish. And they're all laughing every time. It's like, look, I swallow bread. Swallow bread. Yeah. And we actually saw one tragopan. The first one, like we didn't know the male was there. And with the bus kind of came slowly around. And the male was sort of behind a rock. And he sort of gave us like the big eyed, oh, my God. You know, there's a big bus. And he had his whole thing out, you know, the blue skin.
Yeah.
You know, that you never see this in the field, apparently.
Yeah.
So that it's
just basically kind of only in display, right? They just have it when they're displaying. People can't even imagine this. They should Google.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. But the display is actually not something you see in the field. Most of the times, display is seen in captive birds. So we actually, a few of us got the end of the display before it just went like, oh my God, and like wrapped up the whole thing and it went back into its, you know, position hidden underneath the neck. Blood pheasants. Just fantastic stuff.
Are you getting out on a lot of trails to see these?
No, that's the weird thing about birding there. It's like you basically stop the bus along the road. And in most places, there's essentially nobody on the roads. And you walk the roads. And the roads are really narrow, little paved roads everywhere. So you basically stop. And it's like, okay, we're going to try here. And it's one of the major highways, yet it doesn't feel like it. You know, it's only around the major city, like closer to the airport and Thimphu, that there's more traffic. But otherwise...
It's one of the least densely populated countries in the world, I think, right? It's like.
I think so. It's not huge, but it does, you know, you cover small distances, but it takes a lot of time because of the way the roads are and the elevation gain and all that. So the country feels huge when you're there, but in fact, it's really not that big, yet not that many people. And in fact, a lot of youth are leaving, which is kind of worrying, like they, you know, because of jobs and all this. And they've lost something like amazing in the last post-COVID, like something like 10% of the population
is going to
live in Australia. So it's crazy. Hmm. Yeah. But I think it's just a few hundred thousand people that live in the country. That's it. And it's a kingdom, right? It's a Buddhist kingdom. So while it is a democracy, it really, the king is probably really the most powerful person in the country, you know? And when we were getting ready to go, leaving, you know, we're on the plane, we're waiting and stuff. And then I was on the left side of the plane flight attendants come around, they say, the king is going to be boarding this airplane, so please don't take pictures out the left side. I'm like, the king? And
yeah, that's not something you hear a lot when you're on a boarding a flight, you know? You don't hear that very often.
No. So all these dignitaries were lined up, you know, and there's a carpet out there, you know, I could see all these people, military folks, and everybody's dressed, you know, in traditional outfits and all that. And then the king goes and shakes everybody's hand, comes in, you know. We sort of see him like, you know, first class here. you know, sit down, and then he closed the divider. We're like, oh, we're flying with the king. And we find out that the captain, the pilot, is the queen's father. So
oh, wow.
He's a pilot. So he's, you know, flying his, you know, basically this all royal family, like flying the place, you know, and riding. And there's like also a.
So wait, is he one of the 10 pilots that can land in the.
Yeah,
this?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
He is. And there was also somebody from the Middle East who was in the royal Middle Eastern dude. You know, I'm not sure who it was, but he was there hanging out with the king. And
wow. And, what were you wearing?
You know, the shirt that probably said Cape Charles Brewing Company or something like that. I don't know. I was wearing my best attire for travel, of course. Mm-hmm. Don't you travel in a suit and tie and stuff?
Yeah, tux, man.
You know, you guys?
Yeah. Yeah.
But the coolest thing is, like, we arrive in Bangkok, and they open up, you know, the front, whatever, everybody's getting ready to go. And we see the king turn around and come towards economy, talk to a few people in the front. And then he waves at all of us, does, like, thumbs up and little kind of, you know, kind of prayer sign, you know, and I'm like, that's cool. He didn't have to do that. You know, he didn't have to like acknowledge anybody else in the plane. And it was kind of neat. And then we realized that he's going to the coronation of King Charles, what have you, in the UK. So he's probably doing little stopovers, picking up more royals, you know, like a little royal party.
Wow.
And yeah.
Wow. Schmancy. Yeah.
Fifth king of Bhutan. So there you go. But, you know, apart from the birds, the other thing about Bhutan is that the architecture, the temples and the dzongs, which are fortress monasteries that you can go visit and see.
How do you spell that word? Is it D-Z?
Yeah,
D-Z-O-N-G. D-Z-H-O-N-G? Okay. Yeah. Be a great word for the New York Times spelling bee game. Be a really good one.
Yeah. So, and then to get to see all that and the paintings inside and the statues and the culture, it's a truly, some people say, sort of the maybe the best representation of a Buddhist nation, in a sense, you know, the way that it functions within the entire life of the country. And has incorporated itself into the tourism and also the idea of birding and nature observation as part of what they want to promote, as they are trying to do this whole idea of gross national happiness. You know, sort of the country is trying to maintain some level of standard of living and happiness for its people, not just money. But obviously, some things are not going well if people are leaving. So,
do you know how long the king is, the present king has been the king? And I'll tell you why I ask in a second, or if you know.
He's relatively young. So I think his dad's still alive. So K4, king, the fourth king, is still alive. And it might be something like a 10 to 12 years ago that
how old would you guess he is?
How old? I would say he's in his 40s.
This is interesting because Kristen insists she went to the Teton Science School back in, you know, early 2000s or something, late 90s. Uh-huh. And she is always telling me that she went, that while she was there, the Prince of Bhutan was in the science school with her. So I'm like wondering, I'm like, is it the same guy? Like, well, how many princes in Bhutan are there?
Mm. Yeah, well, could be the same guy.
But like, he was interested in nature and science and the stuff you're mentioning, like they've kind of got the mindful nature thing that's pretty ingrained there. Yeah.
But they're also under heavy pressure to make money for the country, so they've had to put in hydro projects that they sell the electricity to India, and they're squeezed between, well, you know, I guess it's Uncle India and Aunt China is what they say, something like that. Like they're the two countries that sort of they are friendly with in some respects, but also realize that they're less, you know, they're the little one in that situation. So they are not there. There's a lot of pressure to develop this and that and do things. And there's this idea now that the lowlands, where there is an area where they could establish a bigger airport, they want to make a bigger city, a free trade / green city where they can employ more people, have Indian people come and do this or that, whatever. I'm still not clear what the plan is, but it's a little different from the past. I think they realize that they need more income to keep the Bhutan idea alive, and they don't know how to create that income just with ecotourism and so forth. So it's a difficult kind of shift, I think, because they've always been sort of the green nation, and now, you know, having to put in these hydroelectric situations is sort of like, oh, you know. And I guess they also do some crypto mining and all that kind of stuff there. So yeah, it seems like the country's at a crossroads. On the other hand, I've never seen so many birders there. I've been there before, Everybody seemed to be there. I don't know if you guys were getting photos from Bhutan from others, but you know, Rock Jumper was there. Golden Gate. Well, the group formerly known as Golden Gate Audubon, because they're going to change their name. I heard the Audubon part's gonna leave. Ansar Khan from India.
Ansar,
Wild Walk Nature Tours. He was there with the clients, and there were other groups around. Lots of birders. It seemed like everywhere we went, we saw birders, and it really showed us to the importance of the birding community outside of the main part of Bhutan, where most of the tourists go. Like once you get into the east, most of the people we saw were birders.
So wow.
That's interesting. And I think there's an opportunity there for the government to say, oh, you know, maybe we could have more nature-oriented travel to facilitate it in some way, not just birders, right? Like people who want to, you know, go hiking through some spots. And
is there a place to see sun bear there? You ever seen sun bear?
I have not seen sun bear. But they do see Asiatic black bear, which I think is a different species there.
Yeah.
There are more tigers there than in India, probably, but nobody sees them.
Right. Hard to see in that terrain.
And guess what? I almost saw a golden cat, but I could not see it. Dorji, our guide, said, there's a golden cat right there. And I look up. And I'm like, I can't see it. Nobody could see it. Oh, it's just right behind the rock. Oh, it's gone. You know, and it missed it. We all missed it.
Wow. But I would, like, I would hate that. I would be so upset. Right. Oh, it's like a taste of honey being worse than none at all.
Yeah. No, but it was fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it just looks so beautiful. And like just apart from the birds, it looks like, you know, what they call it, the hidden kingdom, right? And it's like, it really feels like something out of a fable or a fairy tale just from the imagery.
Right.
And then you throw in these amazing birds. It's like,
yeah, the architecture alone makes it so that you feel like you're, it's really clear where you are, and everywhere you go, the Bhutanese architecture is there. It's not like they just have it in like a couple of tourist towns. Mm. No, it's like the country makes its house in certain ways with ornate, you know, paintings and so forth all over the buildings. So it's super clear cut. And the Tiger's Nest Monastery, it's amazing. You get, you know, you have to sort of climb up there several hours of walking up a trail.
I would not want to have been the construction team for that. I would not own any part of that.
I know. It's like hanging off a cliff.
My God.
Super. It's quite a walk. got to admit. But
looks it.
Not too bad, but not everybody can do it.
So, yeah.
So it was a great trip. And, you know, I think you guys know that's where I went deaf. It was in Bhutan. Right. So I have a kind of a special relationship to the country, and always felt like the people there treated me so nicely that I'm glad to go back and I experienced more of it this time. It was a longer trip, and go back to the spot where it all happened. You know, we had lunch at the hotel where I got kind of carted over there while I was like ill, and they were trying to figure out, you know, what was happening to me. And meanwhile, this time I'm having, we have a breakfast there this time. And I'm like, well, I'm back. This time I'm just having breakfast. You know, I'm not ill like crazy. And it feels, you know, kind of weirdly good to sort of say that, you know, this whole thing didn't defeat me completely. I've been able to go right back to where I was. So that's cool.
It was an interesting post you made about, what did you call it, your deaf-iversary?
Deaf-iversary.
It's I think you captured it well from what I could see. It was an interesting read.
It's an interesting thing to happen in a country where they have a different outlook also, and to be able to get a sense for like the Buddhist idea of, you know, impermanence and kind of change, and not that anger and wanting things is not necessarily how you kind of get through things. You have to get through things by sort of having a different outlook that's a little bit more, in a sense, compassionate towards yourself, you know.
Acceptance, a little bit.
Acceptance, yeah.
Yeah.
So that was good. I mean, it would have been awful if it had happened in the mean streets of Philly, for example.
As one example, yes.
Where people are like, get this guy out of my way. Anyway.
Yeah. Wow.
There you go.
Well, yeah, what an amazing trip. It was fun to follow. And now what? You got what, few days, and you're turning around heading back to Japan.
Spring in Japan.
Yeah. What are you going to be seeing there?
Well, a lot of migrants. I think we're going to go to a couple of migratory hotspots, you know, island out there off the western Japanese coast. And then we'll also be going to the islands down in the south, you know, between Japan and Taiwan, to see those endemics in there, you know, the woodcock and the Okinawa rail and all that kind of stuff. So I'm
the Nansei Shoto.
Yeah. And then I do have a couple of days right after the trip. So I'm going to take a ferry out to another island to see some seabirds. So that's going to be my little vacation for about a day.
Nice.
Whatever it is.
Well, we will be expecting details.
Storm petrels, maybe.
Yeah. Nice.
Those ones you see in the book and you figure, I'm never going to see that.
Like Matsudaira's.
That's right.
Yeah.
I might see that.
Might see Matsudaira's.
Your Swinhoe's.
I've seen that. Easy to see off North Carolina if you go on the right trip. Yeah. Well, Molly, what do you got coming up?
Mostly just enjoying West Virginia, like I said. I'm just anxious to spend some time working in the garden, working on the property. We're going to attempt to dig a pond at some point that's connecting two springs that we have. So that's a big project to get started. I'm going to go spend some time in the mountains here in June. So that's the most of what I have going on. And it feels like my vacation time. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah.
But that's about it. But I guess a couple other things. The birding co-op has some stuff cooking. So I would tell folks to check that out. And I've also been working with the team that puts on Frontiers in Ornithology, the Youth Symposium, which is based in Delaware and is in November. And our registration's open. So it's for ages 13 to 22 and their mentors. And I know we've talked about it a little bit here, and we can talk about it more maybe before the actual event. But registration's actually open for that. So excited that we have that all set up, and go check it out.
Yeah, that's going to be an awesome event. I've been before too, so I'm looking forward to hearing how it goes. And very cool. Yeah, I want to let folks know just briefly. We got to scoot here pretty soon, but last year, Kristen and I endeavored to do a walking big day, and several listeners contributed to that, and I wanted to extend thanks. As it turned out, I think I detailed for most everybody, but maybe not everybody, that we actually got COVID like the day before that walking big day. And then that day, it also poured rain, like poured. So we ended up like doing basically a sick big sit on our back porch, tallying probably something around a dozen species and feeling pretty miserable for the whole entire experience. So we are hoping to improve upon that experience this year. And this will have concluded by the time this podcast airs, but this coming Saturday, we're going to do a walking big day, trying to raise money for In Color Birding Club, which does a lot of amazing outreach and inclusive birding events. For people of color, BIPOC, and they're just doing amazing work. And so we're trying to raise money for In Color Birding Club. I'd encourage folks to go there and check out the site, hit that contribute button, see if maybe you got an extra pair of binoculars to donate or some funds. So we're trying to support the good work being done there. And, you know, even though this big day will have happened by then, we will still be taking donations on the contribute page at In Color Birding Club website. So check that out. And I think I'll also be doing a sort of a modest big day on the Global Big Day with my dad and his best bud, Will Russell from Wings. And Chris and I are going to join the two of them and run around the low country of the Eastern Shore of Maryland, trying to see some birds, do a little informal big day, something my dad's done for many, many years down there. It'll be fun to join him. So that's what we're doing for Global Big Day. You guys got plans for a Global Big Day this coming week or 2 weeks?
I'll be in Japan, so I guess I'll be global.
Yeah. Yeah. Whatever your bird counts, whatever you eat bird.
And we will be trying to maximize Our sightings, as we always do. I'll have to figure out where I'm going to be that day.
So. Yeah, 13th of May. Yeah. Nice. Molly, you got plans?
I've never done a full-out big day on Global Big Day, but I always try to get out and just do some fun birding, whatever I'm feeling locally. Typically on big days or the global big days, I get out and do a lot of like a big hike. Like, so I might go do a big stretch of the rail trail or something like that and just
nice.
Really enjoy it. And yeah, I kind of prioritize that over the species for the most part, because I don't know, it's like a self-care day to me. I think I just want to have fun and look at birds then. So
yeah,
which is different from a normal day of, you know, going out and looking at birds.
right.
Extra intention. So that's my plan.
Nice. Yeah. Excellent. Well, everybody check out Global Big Day. Just eBird what you see on the 13th of May. That'll do it. All sightings count towards that end. So hope people enjoy it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks, Coa Sport Optics, and we'll be back soon with another episode. Take care, everybody.
See you. Bye-bye.